the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at KSFR. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen anytime of day thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to hear a commentary from Ron Bloomberg because today is Tuesday. Right now, I would like to welcome John Perkins. His new book is The Secret History of the American Empire, Economic Hitmen, Jackals, and the Truth About Global Corruption. Welcome to the Radio Cafe, John Perkins.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you back. Probably many of our listeners remember you. A few years ago, your book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, made the New York Times bestseller list. For those regular listeners who haven't read it, or some new listeners, please just remind us of what the term economic hitman means.
Well, I think it's fair to say that we economic hitmen have created the world's first truly global empire in the last few decades, and we've done it primarily without the military. For the first time in history, we've done it primarily through economics, and therefore we've done it in secret also. And the way we work primarily is that we will identify a third world country that has resources our corporations covet, like oil, and then arrange a large loan to that country from the World Bank or one of its sister organizations. But the money never actually goes to the country. Instead, it goes to one of our corporations to build big infrastructure projects in that country, power plants, industrial parks, that sort of thing. And these benefit a few of the very rich people in that country, as well as our own companies, the people who own the industries, et cetera. But they really don't reach the majority of the people at all, because these people are not connected to the electrical grid. They don't have the skills to get jobs in industrial parks. And yet they and the whole country are left holding a huge debt by plan. This debt is so big that the country can't possibly repay it. So at some point we go back to the country and say, you owe us a lot of money, can't pay your debts, so sell your oil real cheap to our oil companies, vote with us on the next critical United Nations vote, or send troops in support of ours to someplace in the world like Iraq. And on the few occasions when we economic hitmen fail, the jackals go in, and we call the jackals the people that will overthrow governments or assassinate their leaders. When the leaders don't cooperate, then they either get overthrown or assassinated. And in this way, we've really managed to create this this first truly global empire.
You point out in your book the fundamental contradiction between our ideals as a nation on the one hand and our actions as empire on the other. Tell us what you mean.
Well, Mary Charlotte, I think, you know, I grew up believing that the things that made America great was our belief in the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, equality and justice for all. And in fact, in executing this foreign policy of ours, we've suppressed those rights in many, many countries around the world. We've literally enslaved people. Our corporations pay them way below decent wages. Some of them live and work in terrible conditions. In places like the Congo, millions of people are dying because of our corporate greed. And so we've really suppressed these ideals that I grew up to believe in. In that process, we've also created a lot of danger for ourselves. We've created a very dangerous world, a world of terrorism, a world of global warming. And in fact, all of this is coming back to haunt us, because now we're finding in our own borders that economic hitmen techniques are being used against us. People are being encouraged to take huge amounts of debt. Even teenagers, when they turn 18, get these credit cards. And we're losing our pensions. We're losing our rights to unionize. We're losing our Social Security, welfare, a lot of our civil rights. And so in many respects, these things are coming back to haunt us. So I really am concerned that since World War II, there's been a constant degrading of these principles. And in fact, we really have to ask ourselves whether we really can claim to be a democracy, not because of chads or stolen elections so much as because a democracy is built on the premise that the electorate is informed. If most of our people don't realize that we've created this empire, don't realize that they're luxuriating in the fruits of this empire, then it's hard to say that they're informed voters.
When you just said a moment ago, these economic hitmen techniques are being used against us. The whole setup of the economic hitman empire scheme that you describe in both of these books is very conscious. It's not sort of some kind of invisible hand guiding the market. I mean, it's a scheme. What about this whole credit card debt? Do you think that is also some kind of thought-out scheme to keep people subservient in debt and so on?
Yes, you know, this isn't a conspiracy theory at all. I don't believe in this is a conspiracy. It's not like there's a group of people that have to get together and conspire to do something illegal. It's that the leaders of our corporations, what I call the corporatocracy, all went basically to the same schools. They understand how to keep control over the system. Inherently, they understand it without having to conspire to make it work. And, yeah, the tremendous debt that we have, beginning with young people, and then when people finish college, they usually are deeply in debt. It means they're going to have to toe the line, and they're going to have to work for the corporations to pull themselves out of debt and not object too much and not think too much. And so we've created this culture that's very oriented toward consumption and not very oriented at all toward thinking about what we're doing. You know, today we in the United States are less than 5% of the world's population. We consume more than 25% of the world's resources and create more than 30% of the world's pollution. That's not a viable model. It's a failure as a model. We can't share this model. We can't send this model to China, who has 20% of the world's population, or India with 17%. It's just not a sustainable model, and it will not last. It's going to change, and we need to understand that and work very hard to make it change in a way that will allow our children and grandchildren to inherit a sustainable, stable, and peaceful world rather than the kind of world that we're creating today, which is a very dangerous, unstable, and unsustainable world.
In order for what you call the corporatocracy to work, it has to have the rule of law behind it. What are the laws, the tools, the mechanisms in our government and in world bodies that make it possible for the corporatocracy to do legally the things that you're talking about?
Well, you're absolutely right, Mary Charlotte. You bring up a real interesting case, because when I became an economic hitman, my mentor, this amazing woman whose name was Claudine, told me, you know, she said, you won't be called upon to do anything illegal. It is dirty, but it's not illegal. And in fact, if I were your banker and I were to coerce you into accepting a loan that I knew was so big that you couldn't possibly repay it because I wanted to get a favor from you later on, that would be illegal. But when we do it on an international basis through the World Bank with countries, it's not illegal because we've written those laws. All of these international laws that deal with free trade, CAFTA, NAFTA, privatization, so many of the rules and regulations around the World Bank and even the United Nations are structured very much in our favor, in the favor of empire building, so that we can do these things that are illegal. However, they're very immoral, they're very unjust, they're very contrary to American principles, and in the long run, they're creating tremendous problems for us around the world and ultimately at home.
We're talking to John Perkins. The book is called The Secret History of the American Empire. You give lots of examples throughout the book. The book is divided up into sort of geographically into regions of the world, and you start with Asia and give the example of sweatshops that are operating in many countries, which gives a lot of the products that I'm probably wearing right now, shoes, clothes, and so on. What are the conditions like in sweatshops? And let's speak to this point of the laws that regulate or fail to regulate them.
The conditions in these sweatshops are just abysmal. People receiving less than $2 a day in many cases, and people will sometimes tell you, well, $2 a day is a lot of money in Indonesia. Well, it isn't. I talk in the book about this couple from the United States who went and lived with Nike sweatshop workers in Indonesia. And in the first month, they lost tremendous amounts of weight, got very, very sick. They just couldn't live that way. Abysmal conditions. And as an example, they're only allowed 2 bathroom breaks a day, and that includes women who are menstruating. Imagine what that's like. Just 2 bathroom breaks a day. Just terrible, terrible conditions at very, very low wages. And all that so that we can get cheap T-shirts, and you mustn't wear those anymore, Mary Charlotte. You know, we've got to make sure that we don't do that anymore. And at the same time, these corporations like Nike that are forcing people to, or not forcing perhaps, but putting people, submitting people to these awful conditions, are also paying their own executives, their CEO, huge salaries, and paying big sports stars like Tiger Woods and many, many others millions and millions of dollars. So this is not, I don't think, the type of world that you and I want to live in or pass on to future generations.
But what about the laws? I mean, what laws, both national and international, regulate sweatshops like these? I mean, I've seen documentaries where there are laws, but they're only enforced, followed the day before some kind of investigators or health company regulators or whatever, I mean, health agency regulators come in to check the particular sweatshops.
Well, you know, so much of this system is based upon corrupting officials in these countries. And it's easy to write these problems off and say, oh, that's just because of the corrupt officials. But the fact is, officials don't just become corrupt by themselves. Somebody corrupts them. And that was my job. That's what economic hitmen do. And today, all the major corporations, like the ones I mentioned, like Nike and Monsanto and the oil companies, have their own equivalent of economic hitmen and go in and pay off officials to write laws that allow them to do things that are abysmal. And so in all these cases, there are collaborators in these other countries, corrupt officials, but it's the economic hitmen who are corrupting these people.
We're talking to John Perkins. There's a lot of things that come up in this book that are sort of interesting in a horrifying way. One is you talk about an Indonesian popular movement to protect its natural resources and how it was crushed after the tsunami to some extent under the pretext of disaster aid.
Yeah, I think it's a terrible comment on our society these days that we take tremendous advantage of disasters around the world, like that tsunami. You're referring to the Aceh movement in the province of Aceh, Indonesia, which Aceh has been a very suppressed area in Indonesia, and our U.S. military aid to the Indonesian government has been very strong in suppressing it, primarily because it's still what we would call a communist holdout. Although if you go to Aceh and you get to know the people there, it's not really a communist movement as so much as an independence movement where they feel that they've been crushed over the years and want better rights in Aceh or to secede from Indonesia, one or the other. And after the tsunami, we used this as an excuse, and the Indonesian government used this as an excuse to go in and crush this movement. But another way that tsunami, as so often as the case happens, was used to enhance the pocketbook of the corporatocracy was that, you know, we all hear after a natural disaster like that a lot of foreign aid goes to these countries. And in fact, at the very beginning, there is foreign aid that goes in to erect tents and bring in water and food, emergency equipment. That is altruistic. But very soon after that, the billions of dollars and sometimes trillions of dollars that we hear about that's sent in to rebuild that area is used in a very different way. So rather than helping the small fishermen who were in the area before build new boats and new storage facilities, rather than helping small farmers rebuild their farms and the mom-and-pop restaurants and bed and breakfasts to rebuild themselves, this foreign aid is used to help big corporations move in, big fishing industries to move in and build big storage units and big agriculture to come in and huge hotel chains and restaurant chains to move in. So it's,
and that goes under the name of post-disaster aid.
Yes, that goes under the name of post-disaster aid and foreign aid in general. You know, most Americans think that foreign aid is altruistic, and they say, oh, how can these people be so angry at us and hate us? We send them money all the time. Well, it just isn't true. A very little bit of foreign aid is altruistic, like immediately after a disaster. But the vast majority of foreign aid is not used to help people in these countries. It's used to help our own corporations, and it's used to help us corrupt local officials and basically create this empire. And we need to change that.
We're talking to John Perkins. And we'll get to, because I know this is something that, you talk about a lot in your book, and when you talk to, when you go around the country and talk to people, is the ways that this can change. But I want to stay on this, whole legal thing for a moment. Are there ways in which the what you call the corporatocracy, the corporate government alliance, actually breaks its own laws? Are there illegal activities going on in this domain?
Well, certainly there are illegal activities. I mean, but in many cases, the corporatocracy and the big corporations set it up so that what you and I would consider to be illegal activities are not illegal activities. For example, here's a pretty blatant one. In Sudan right now, we all know that there's death and destruction going on there, but there's also a very, very active slave trade, and it's primarily a sexual slave trade. And actually, all through Africa, I just met with some Ethiopian women a couple of days ago, and they were talking about how in their country, women are sold by their local community, sometimes by their parents, to corporations to become part of this trade, and then you can actually go on the internet and order a mail order bride from these countries, and usually those women have no say in it. Sometimes they go voluntarily because they're starving, and it's their only way of seeing themselves get out of starvation. But once they arrive in the United States or their final destination, there are absolutely no laws that control the way that they're handled, other than the normal laws of domesticity. So they can be treated very, very brutally, and they don't even know what the laws are. That's a pretty blatant example. And yet, it theoretically is not illegal, because it would be very difficult to prove that these women were in any way coerced into doing this. It's not illegal to put your name up on the Internet as somebody who wants to get married. But this is a very active trade where third parties are making tremendous amounts of money. The women aren't getting the money. The money is being made by other people. That sort of thing goes on a lot. But more common is just that corporations doing things that they've written laws that very much favor them. For example, right now there's a big lawsuit in Ecuador, the largest environmental lawsuit in the history of the world, $6 billion being filed as a lawsuit on behalf of 30,000 Amazonian people against Texaco, now owned by Chevron, for dumping more than 30 times the amount of oil dumped by the Exxon Valdez in the Ecuadorian Amazon. And Texaco's defense is that they didn't break any laws, that they were allowed to do this in Ecuador, which to a certain degree is true. You have to pay fines, but they're very small fines. But they wrote these laws, and they knew full well that the laws that they were corrupting local officials to pass, which they did pass through tremendous bribes and corruption, Texaco knew full well that this was going to be extremely destructive. This was going to end up in causing people to die from toxic waste and destruction of the Amazon. I mean, Texaco had tremendous experience in many other parts of the world where they knew how to mitigate against oil spills like this, but they chose instead to corrupt the local government and thereby destroy an amazing amount of rainforest and kill a lot of people.
Is this case still going on?
Yes, it's been going on for 14 years, and I actually think that the opposition is going to win it at this point, which is really interesting. It's being led by a U.S. attorney from New York, a guy named Stephen Danziger, an amazing lawyer, and also Ecuadorian lawyers who are involved. It was written up in Vanity Fair in the April edition in a big way. And one of the really interesting things about this, Mary Charlotte, is that Danziger and his people are not doing this pro bono. They're not doing it for free. They would be willing to, but they've decided that they're spending millions of dollars on this case themselves, and they decided that they would like to make millions and millions of dollars when they win the case, not because they want the money so much as they want to set an example. And they figure that if they win this case and their firm makes a lot of money, the word will get out very quickly, and other law firms will then start to file suit against the oil companies in Nigeria and in Indonesia and all over the world, and perhaps other companies, perhaps those companies that run sweatshops, start to file class action suits and know that they can get very handsomely compensated for that when they win the cases. And I think that's a, you know, it's setting a new principle of law, which I find very fascinating.
We're talking to John Perkins. The time is almost 8:30. John Perkins, stay on the phone with us for just a moment. We're going to hear a commentary from Ron Bloomberg, and then we'll be right back.
Okay.
It's Ron Bloomberg, just a voice in the crowd. It can't be, but it's true. This week, Lena Horne turns 90. Has there ever been a woman more beautiful than Lena Horne? How big a movie star could she have been if there wasn't a color barrier in the 40s and 50s? Even in cameo roles, they had to shoot her in such a way that she could easily be edited out so as not to offend the sensibilities of some of the southern states. Talk about blind prejudice. And Mr. Warmth, Dick Cheney, made headlines again. Seems he declared his vice president's office wasn't an entity of the executive branch, so he didn't have to report classified and declassified government documents. What a duo, Cheney and Bush. Bush actually said this recently. I'm honored to be here with the eternal general of the United States, mi amigo Alberto Gonzalez. Eternal. He may mean it. And Barry Bonds will soon break Hank Aaron's all-time record. When he does, maybe at the seventh inning stretch, we sing, take me out to the ball game, take me out with the crowd, buy me some steroids and Cracker Jack, suddenly my head won't fit in my cap. And speaking of songs, here's one of the greatest recordings ever.
Oh, no, why? There's no sun up in the sky. Stormy weather since my man and I ain't together. Keeps raining all the time. Life is bare, gloom and misery everywhere. Stormy weather.
Happy birthday, Miss Lena Horne. And I'll talk to you next week, if you have a minute.
You can hear Ron every Tuesday on the Radio Cafe, on Thursdays after the noon news, and Saturdays following Bob Edwards.
And we are on the telephone with John Perkins, author of the book, The Secret History of the American Empire, Economic Hitmen, Jackals, and the Truth About Global Corruption. Let's look at the situation in Iraq in the context of economic hitmen. We know what the war is not about. We know it's not about 9/11. We know it's not about Al-Qaeda. We know it's not about weapons of mass destruction. From your point of view, what is it about?
Well, I'm very familiar with what happened in Iraq, Mary Charlotte, and it's an instance of when economic hitmen fail and the jackals fail, and then as a last resort, the military goes in. In the 1970s, I was deeply involved in bringing the royal family of Saudi Arabia around to our side after the oil embargoes of the early 70s. And I talk extensively in the book about how we struck this incredible deal with the House of Saud, whereby they would send most all of the money they made selling oil to the world back to the United States, invested in U.S. government securities. And the interest from that securities would be used by the Treasury Department to hire U.S. companies to build up Saudi Arabia, to essentially to westernize it, to build desalinization plants, petrochemical complexes, entire cities from the desert. It was extremely successful. I put that deal together in the 70s, and it really brought Saudi Arabia into our pockets. And we also guaranteed that as long as the House of Saud kept their end of this deal, we would see to it that they would stay in power. This deal has endured up until now. After that was accepted by them, we decided that Saddam Hussein should accept a similar deal. And he was really our man. You know, he'd worked for the CIA. We'd actually hired him as an assassin when he was in high school to take out the democratically elected president at that time named Qasem. Saddam failed. And the CIA executed Qasem on public television in Iraq. But we had a long history with Saddam, in other words. And so in the 80s, the economic hitmen went in and tried to sell him the same deal that the Saudis had accepted. But for some reason, he didn't accept the deal. And so we sent the jackals in to assassinate him, but they couldn't. His security was very good, and he had a lot of lookalike doubles. Hard to assassinate a man who has lookalike doubles. So because we failed, we took the last resort and we sent the military in 91. Now, they destroyed his army, could have taken him out at that point, but didn't want to, because Saddam was the kind of guy we like, a strong man who could keep the oil flowing, who could keep the Iranians on their behind their borders. And we figured that once his army was destroyed, he would be sufficiently chastised that we could bring him around. We were wrong. The economic hitmen and the jackals both failed again during the 90s. And so once again, we sent in the military. And, of course, in this process, we've created a situation where our construction companies are, tremendous numbers of American companies are prospering phenomenally in Iraq. You and I may look at Iraq as a war we're losing, but the big corporations don't feel that they're losing anything. They're making tremendous amounts of money there.
So from that point of view, do you think if you were sitting in the vice president's office of the United States right now, would you consider Iraq a success?
If I were sitting in the vice president's office right now and I were a vice president who has tremendous amounts of stock in Halliburton, I would consider Iraq a success. But for you and me, it's certainly not a success. And for all the men and women who've died there, it's not a success. American men and women, Iraqi men and women, and many men and women around the world. It just points up that we really, our government is controlled by what I call the corporatocracy. And in fact, our current vice president is a great example of that. At the very top, you can't distinguish between who runs our big corporations and who runs our government. They're the same people. They just keep moving around through the revolving door. And incidentally, this is true whether we have a Democrat or a Republican in the White House or running Congress. The corporatocracy, those people who run our big corporations, really control our politics. They go through the revolving door. And in addition to that, all of our political campaigns are funded primarily from money that comes through corporations, usually through people who make their money off the corporations as private individuals, but it comes through the corporations. And the politicians are very beholden to corporations, as is the media. The media is, for the most part, either outright owned by the corporations or beholden to them through their advertisements.
Except for KSFR, ladies and gentlemen.
Exactly.
Community radio.
KSFR, an independent radio and community radio, is so important to our democracy right now, extremely important, because you're not included in what I just described.
We're talking to John Perkins. The fact of the Iraq War has created something that I don't know whether it was foreseen or not, but a huge deficit in the United States budget. I mean, so vast that regular people can't even comprehend it in terms of what we think of as our salaries in our regular context of what money means. Where does this huge deficit put us on the world scale and in this whole question of the American empire?
We're the largest debtor nation in the world today, and the largest debtor nation in history. We're up to our eyeballs in debt. It's phenomenal how much debt we have. But that same deal that we struck with the Saudis in the 70s that I mentioned, I was hired by the Treasury Department to strike that deal. That put us in a very remarkable position. We had gone off the gold standard under Nixon in 1971. By 1973, we were now on what you could call the oil standard. So as part of the deal with the Saudis, they agreed to only buy oil for dollars. And OPEC had to follow suit because Saudi had so much oil. So around the world, you can only buy oil for dollars on the international market these days. With one exception, there is a free market in Iraq, which is one of the problems that we have with Iraq, that where you can buy oil for other currencies. And nobody's really doing it, but you theoretically could. But since you can only buy oil for dollars, it means that the dollar is the world's standard currency. And as long as we're the standard currency, the debt isn't terribly important to us, because if people call in their debt, other countries, Korea or China or Japan, we can just print more dollars, and they have to accept them. However, if we were to go off the dollar as the world currency, if people could buy oil or other major commodities for yen or euros, for example, then we could be in big trouble, because a country like China could call in the debt that we owe them and ask for it in euros, and we wouldn't be able to pay it.
No empire lasts forever. Empires rise and fall. They're replaced by other ones. Do you see the American empire falling and being replaced by, say, China?
The American empire is kind of in collapse.
What are the signs of that collapse?
Well, you just mentioned one big one, this huge debt that we have, and the fact that there are people threatening to open oil bursts, oil exchanges in many places. The fact that I just came from Washington, D.C., and the scuttlebutt down there is that people are very, very frightened that we're going to have to get out of Iraq, or at least almost out of Iraq, maybe with a very small presence there, and that the whole Middle East is going to fall, including Israel, possibly. And there's a real fear there. And if that happens, we lose all our access to Middle East oil. So the empire really is crumbling. We see a huge revolt in Latin America where over 80% of the population of South America in the most recent elections voted in presidents who said no more exploitation by foreign corporations, especially U.S. corporations. So there's many, many signs, and I talk about those in detail in The Secret History. But we really don't want this empire to collapse, Mary Charlotte, because when empires collapse, a vacuum is created, and then there's wars, and a new empire emerges. So what we really must do at this point in history is transform this empire, turn it into something that really represents the American ideals, and let that serve as a model for the world. We need to move into a new world. We need to do something that's never been done in history before, to create something that will really establish a world that's sustainable, peaceful, and stable. And I think we're in a position to do that, and I think Americans in the last 2.5 years, as I've been traveling around the country since Confessions was first published, I've seen a huge awakening amongst us and a real desire to change. And there's lots of movies and books that are exposing the secrets to this empire, and lots of reasons for us to have hope that we can move forward and change this.
Well, do we then cease to be an empire? I mean, are we then a world of happy sovereign nations living in environmental harmony and mutual respect? I mean, where's the empire piece go?
Well, the fact of the matter is that today, in the old days, which are pretty recent, you look at the world as this place with 180-some-odd countries, and a few of them dominated. The Soviet Union and the United States vied for a long time, and then we emerged victorious, and now you've got China coming into the scene. But today, that's irrelevant. Today, you might better visualize the world as these huge clouds drifting over the globe. And these clouds know no national borders. These are the big corporations. You talk about China, replacing us as the empire. The fact of the matter is China's cutting amazing deals with our corporations. They're in partnership. So China's really kind of buying into part of the same thing. So it's really the corporations that are controlling the world, and they're in the process of doing that in China, too. Now, the government of China owns 50 or 51% of many of the Chinese corporations, so there's still the government involvement there. But the fact of the matter is this empire is for the most part at this point in time, headquartered in the United States. But in fact, it's much more than just an American empire. And so I think for us to change this, what we must do is change the corporations so that their main objective is not to make a few rich people a lot richer, the maximizing profit, but instead their objective becomes one of being good communities, creating a world that's safe and stable and sustainable for all of us, taking good care of their employees now and after they're retired, taking good care of all the people around the world that provide the inputs to these corporations and the communities and environments where these people live, becoming good citizens, good communities. And because of the fact of the matter is more people on this planet today see a corporation as their primary community than a village or a town or a state or a country. And I'm very confident that we can do this because whenever we've set our hearts and minds to changing corporations, we've been very, very successful. For example, we've gotten them to clean up terribly polluted rivers in the United States, and we've gotten them to open their doors to minorities and to get rid of aerosol cans that were destroying the ozone layer, to put seatbelts and airbags in cars, although Detroit initially resisted it. Recently, we've gotten McDonald's and Kentucky Fried Chicken off trans fat foods, and just recently, this past week, Tyson's, the big chicken company, ran a full-page ad in the New York Times saying because you, the consumer, demanded it, we are no longer going to give any of our chickens antibiotics. We have tremendous control over corporations. They depend on us to buy their goods and services. And now it's time to exercise that control to really change the basic premise of why corporations exist. They should exist to be good communities, good citizens, to serve us.
The model that we have now is that they exist to make profits. What happens in your dream of this nice future to that profit incentive?
Well, there's no law that says corporations have to make profit. And this certainly, a lot of people believe there is such a law. There isn't. If there were, then CEOs couldn't pay themselves such huge salaries. But the fact of the matter is, you know, profit is not a bad thing. If you want to get investors, you've got to pay them a decent return on their investment. When I was a kid growing up, there was what we call the blue chip stocks, and they were very good stocks, and they paid 2, 3, 4% above inflation. That's very reasonable. People who invest in corporations should be able to get a reasonable return. But over the past couple of decades, especially big investors, have come to look at windfall profits, huge profits, not 2, 3, or 4% above inflation, but huge profits, which means gouging everybody else, setting up sweatshops, destroying environments, creating huge problems around the world. There's no reason for that. We don't need those kinds of profits. This is something entirely new in history. It's not necessary.
And how do you reverse that trend? I mean, people who are investing in the stock market, that's what they're looking for. They're not. Many people don't even know what companies they're invested in. They're just buying things that are in mutual funds or that somebody else is buying for them that give you the highest rate of return.
Yes, but in the 50s and 60s, people were looking for returns of 2 or 3% above inflation, and we're very happy to receive that. They also expected to get good pensions from their own employers and Social Security and so forth. I think we look at a situation where people are willing to accept less rates of return in exchange for a world that is going to survive, a sustainable, peaceful, and stable world. Otherwise, as you mentioned, empires always collapse. This one will collapse too, and there'll be wars, and a new empire will emerge. We don't want that to happen. You know, none of us really needs to make tremendous amounts of money. What we all really want is good food, good homes, good health care, good education for our children, and we want to know that when we retire, we will continue to have all those things. There's no reason why we can't have that and also create a world that is stable, sustainable, and peaceful. We just really need to look at what serves our own self-interest best. And we need to understand that our children and grandchildren can't grow up in an inequitable world unless every child growing up in Africa, Asia, Middle East, and Latin America also has that expectation, because it's a very, very small world today.
We're talking to John Perkins. His book is called The Secret History of the American Empire. Your book has been translated into Spanish and into various languages, and I guess people are reading it in Latin America. What kind of response have you gotten there?
Yeah, well, Confessions is in over 30 languages, I think, at this point. And I just came back from Nicaragua, Ecuador, Bolivia, where people are really loving these books, you know. And the presidents of these countries, who are some of these presidents who recently were elected democratically, who have stood up and said, no more exploitation by foreign corporations. Ecuador's oil ought to help the Ecuadorian people, and profits from Bolivia's gas ought to help the Bolivian people. And the presidents, and I met with several of them in their cabinets, are saying, you know, what's described in Confessions of an Economic Hitman is absolutely true, and the same is true for Secret History. In fact, I tell a lot of these stories in Secret History of the meetings with these presidents in their cabinets, and how they said, yeah, we were visited by economic hitmen, and as soon as we won the election here, somebody appeared in our office, an economic hitman, and said, listen, you know, congratulations, you won, and now I want you to understand I can make you and your family fabulously rich if you play our game, or I can see to it that you're thrown out in a coup or assassinated like Allende and Arbenz and Roldos and Torrijos and Lumumba and Diem and so on and so forth, if you decide to keep your campaign promises. And these presidents are saying, this happened to us. What Perkins is describing in his books is exactly what happens down here. And it's terrifying. Imagine, Mary Charlotte, if you were one of these presidents and you'd run with a lot of integrity to help your people and you win the election, and then this character shows up in your office and tells you, I can make you very, very rich, keep you in office, or I can see it to it you're thrown out of office or assassinated. What would you do?
You know, it's funny. I was back east recently, and I ran into an acquaintance who is a cabinet minister in Chile under the socialist government there, and I asked him if he knew of your work. And he said, you know, I haven't seen that kind of thing in Chile. Yes, it was going on in the 70s, you know, here all over Latin America, but I just don't see that right now.
Yeah, well, I can't speak to Chile. I haven't been there, but I just, as I said, came from Bolivia, Ecuador, and Nicaragua, where I was told exactly the opposite of that, you know, that all these people have seen that. Hugo Chavez has waved my book around and said this is exactly what happened to me. In fact, in Secret History, I quote him speaking over the BBC when he talked about the economic hitmen that had come in exactly as it's described in the book. So I don't know. Perhaps it hasn't happened to the Bachelet administration in Chile, but it certainly has happened in many other places.
The country of Ecuador is very close to your heart. You've done a lot of work to help indigenous people of the Amazon. Have you seen positive changes there? Well, you were talking about that lawsuit of indigenous people being pitted against the oil companies. Have you seen the indigenous people actually win any of their battles?
Yes, the indigenous people have won tremendous battles in Ecuador. The new president there, Rafael Correa, is their person. They supported him, and he ran on a campaign that was saying we are going to keep Ecuador's resources for Ecuador's people. They very much wanted to see him win. His opponent, Noboa, was a real conservative U.S. puppet, a billionaire, the wealthiest man in Ecuador. The indigenous people really got behind Correa, and he won by a very large majority, and now seems to be moving forward to keep his policies. The previous president there, Gutierrez, had run on similar policies and won, and then changed his policies. Actually, the first month he was in office, he flew up to Washington, and there were famous pictures of him holding hands with George Bush plastered on buildings in Ecuador. People were very disturbed. He began cutting sweet deals with the oil companies, World Bank, and IMF. And the people who voted him in, especially the indigenous people, took to the streets and eventually threw him out of office. He had to flee the country. And then they had another series of elections and elected the current president, Correa, who ran on a similar platform and seems to be really holding his own and keeping his campaign promises.
Some of your other books are, I guess, influenced by the shamanic work of the people in the Amazon. They're titled Shape-Shifting Psychonavigation, The World Is As You Dream It. What is the relationship, if there is one, between your other books and this economic hitman work that you do?
I'm so glad you asked that question, Mary Charlotte. No, very few interviewers do that. You're going very deep here, and I appreciate it. My work with shamanism has had a huge, huge influence on my life. The shamans teach us that all things are possible. We can transform anything. It just takes intent and energy to turn things around, whether it's personal health issues or whether it's global issues. And so the shamans have been people, and the indigenous people have very much influenced me to realize that we really can turn things around, that we can change things. And so I see these two books, Confessions of an Economic Hitman and The Secret History of the American Empire, as kind of the next step to those books that were purely about shamanism, like the ones you mentioned, Shape-Shifting and The World Is As You Dream It, because these really are saying, look, you know, we can turn things around. And incidentally, our founding fathers who fought in the American Revolution had these same beliefs. And they got a lot of them from the indigenous people in our country, including the system of government, which somewhat modeled the Iroquois system. And they really believed that, you know, they could defeat the largest empire in the history of the world at that time. And I also believe that we can defeat the corporatocracy at this time to create a better world. It's interesting to me that our founding fathers were not desperate people. They weren't poor people. and they turned out to be insurgents, traitors, terrorists, if you will. They stood up to the largest empire in the history of the world at that time, and it happened to be their own government. And they did it because, not because they were desperate, but because they believed that they needed to create something better for future generations. And I think we're in a similar situation today.
John Perkins, we have just 1 minute left. There's resistance movements all over the world. Are they unified? Are first world and third world groups working together against the corporatocracy?
To some degree, they're unified, and they're becoming more and more unified. In Latin America now, a lot of alliances between these countries there that are becoming unified. And also, interestingly, there's a lot of attempts at unification between Latin American countries and African and Asian countries increasingly. And we're also seeing a lot of our NGOs, nonprofit organizations, getting involved. So there's that attempt. I think it's just really beginning, but I think it'll continue to grow. And I think it behooves all of us to really take a look at where we are today and where we want to go, and to realize that we really need to create a sustainable, peaceful, and stable world for every child being born everywhere on this planet. And if we do so, we'll create a great world for our own children. And we must move forward, each one of us, and make that happen.
John Perkins, thank you so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
You're welcome, Mary Charlotte. My pleasure. Keep up your great work spreading the word.
Thank you so much, and we hope to see you in Santa Fe one of these days again.
Oh, me too.
John Perkins is the author of the book Confessions of an Economic Hitman, and his latest book is called The Secret History of the American Empire, Economic Hitmen, Jackals, and the Truth About Global Corruption. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. And this show is podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show any time of day or night thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the Jazz Hoedown. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte, and tomorrow we're going to be talking about animals. So keep your radio dial tuned to KSFR. Hasta la vista. Ciao.